Welcome to Public Health Out Loud, public health for the public. My name is Dr. Philip Chan. On behalf of the Rhode Island Department of Health, there's been a lot of talk these days about the benefits of mindfulness. Joining us today is Dr. Eric Laux, a professor, researcher, and innovator in the field of mindfulness and health. He's director of the Mindfulness Center at Brown University and has been practicing mindfulness himself for over 25 years. He's here to explain what mindfulness is and some of the benefits. Dr. Laux, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Yeah, it's a real pleasure to be here. I used to work with the Department of Health a little bit, and so I very much value the work that's being done there and happy to connect with you in this way today.
Thank you for the kind words. Why don't you just start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Sure. About myself, well, I am the father of twin 13-year-old girls and married to the love of my life, and I surf and rock climb and play mandolin. And then career-wise, you know, I am in the Department of Epidemiology at the Brown University School of Public Health and really enjoy like methods, like really strong study designs. And so I've tried to bring those methods to the mindfulness field to look at as well-developed randomized controlled trials as I can do with a particular angle towards fostering well-being in young adults, as well as reducing the risk for cardiovascular disease, which continues to be the number one cause of death in the world and in the United States.
So let's start with some of the basics. When we hear, I feel like there's so much out there about mindfulness, you know, what it is, what it isn't. In your expert opinion, how would you describe mindfulness? What is it?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the most common definitions is that mindfulness is the awareness that comes from being in the present moment, non-judgmentally. And, you know, it sort of has like a couple components to it. So one is like present moment awareness of like our thoughts, our emotions, physical sensations. And then a second piece is like the quality of that awareness, that it's non-judgmental, it's curious, there's friendliness there, gentleness. I sometimes think of it as just like a scientist just observing the data coming in. So can we observe the data coming in through our senses, whether it's like sound or taste or touch or sight, and just respond skillfully to those data? And another element of mindfulness is the concept of like remembering. And I often think of it as like remembering to bring our wisdom into this present moment. So wherever we get our wisdom from, whether it's through like public health messages about how we should eat or physical activity that we should get or whatever it is, or maybe it's through our own hard-fought experience or something that we've learned from someone who we really respect, it doesn't really matter if we have that wisdom unless we bring it right here, right now. And an element of mindfulness is connecting in, like remembering our wisdom and bringing it to this moment so that we can really manifest the most skillful responses to life as it happens.
So I think when I've traditionally thought of mindfulness, I sort of think about it as potentially meditation and potentially more sort of in the realm of addressing mental health benefits, especially in this day and age, right, where everything's on demand and, you know, you have five screens in front of you and, you know, you have all these alerts going off. Talk to us about what the benefits of mindfulness are in general, and especially as it relates to mental health, but it's so much more.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a very active couple of decades for mindfulness research in the PubMed database through the United States National Library of Medicine. I put in mindfulness the other day, 29,000 peer-reviewed publications came out. So there's a lot happening. Some of the biggest signals for mindfulness training have been on outcomes like stress, depression symptoms, building evidence on improving anxiety symptoms. We're seeing nice benefits around pain management and also with reducing overuse of opioids, and then increasingly emerging out into like cardiometabolic risk factors, like say healthy eating or physical activity. But those data are less advanced than some of the mental health outcomes that have really been researched sizably for decades.
And let me ask you this. This is an even more basic question, perhaps, but how does focusing on the present moment help a person deal with depression, anxiety, stress?
Yeah. Well, say if we take the example of depression, one of the best interventions developed for it is called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, or MBCT. And so what they've found is that when folks are dealing with a episode of depression, that say our thoughts can kind of like spiral downwards, and that negative thoughts can lead to more negative thoughts, which can lead to more negative thoughts. And it can be just like a tough place to be. And so mindfulness training, one is it helps with our self-awareness, that it helps us just notice where our thoughts are, and what our emotions are. We don't necessarily need to do anything about them, but we become more aware of like where our mind is, knowing that our thoughts are just our thoughts, that we don't necessarily need to act on them unless we choose to. And so say if our thoughts are like, yep, I'm having like a series of negative thoughts here, and I've been in this place for like some period of time now. So that self-awareness comes. And then the other piece that meditation and mindfulness training with is attention control. So being able to place our minds where we choose to place it. And so it seems like programs like mindfulness-based cognitive therapy can help people, one, realize that they're in a negative thought spiral, but secondly, is it can give them the attentional control to actually bank out of that negative thought spiral, to be able to place their mind or their thoughts into a place that is more skillful for them to be in that particular moment. And by repeating that over and over again, it seems to be able to help people prevent like relapses of depression from coming in. You know, they're not trying to like prevent negative thoughts from happening. Actually, negative thoughts can be really helpful. Like, it's good for us to know when challenges are there, so we're not like blocking them. We're just noticing if they're helpful still. And if they are, keep going. If they aren't, then can we use our training and attention control to actually bring our thoughts to somewhere that's maybe a little more productive or beneficial for us in that moment. So that's like an example of some of the mechanisms by which mindfulness training seems to help with depression symptoms. But you could see it could be similar, say, if we're, you know, really finding ourselves very reactive to stressful situations, or if we're finding ourselves in a place of worrying a lot too, say with anxiety.
All I can say, Dr. Laux, is where were you during the COVID pandemic? We could have used you over at the Department of Health with some mindfulness exercises, probably daily, for sure.
Yeah.
Maybe next pandemic, thanks. We'll give you a call and you sure can help manage some of our stress levels.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And actually, my colleague Judson Brewer at Brown University wrote a book called Unwinding Anxiety and has developed a whole program for anxiety itself. And he was very active during the pandemic, released a series of very short videos. And so he's done quite a bit of active work on the like health front to be able to combat anxiety in society.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about some of the other uses of mindfulness. Now, you recently published a study in JAMA Network Open, which is part of this prestigious journal group in medicine. Tell us about this study and how you came to think about mindfulness and apply it in this way.
Sure. Yeah. So this was a randomized controlled trial of a little over 200 participants, all who had high blood pressure. And we developed a mindfulness program called mindfulness-based blood pressure reduction. So it was actually adapted to folks with high blood pressure to be able to train them up in mindfulness skills, like I mentioned, like self-awareness or attention control or emotion regulation, but then direct those skills towards their relationship with the things that we know drive blood pressure. So things like their diet, physical activity, alcohol consumption, stress reactivity, and even use of blood pressure medication. So we hope that by really adapting it and directing it towards the major drivers of blood pressure, that we would boost effects, the basics of that particular study.
And so with what you just mentioned a few minutes ago, just being aware sort of in the moment what you're eating, is that sort of the hypothesis behind why mindfulness could help improve blood pressure?
Yeah, it was like, it's a multifaceted intervention. So, you know, we meet 2.5 hours a week for 8 weeks plus an all-day retreat. So there's about 30 hours of contact time. And certainly an element is training and self-awareness. And we'll bring in, say, different kinds of foods that are like either like emotionally challenging, you know, like say sweet foods or salty foods or even healthy foods that can be emotionally challenging, and invite people to notice their thoughts, emotions, physical sensations before, during, and after eating them. And so say some people who have something sweet or processed, you know, they might find that they get like a sugar high and then a sugar crash, you know, and others don't really find that at all. And we just bring awareness to that. And during the all-day retreat, you know, we cater like a really tasty lunch that's consistent with the DASH diet, and even invite people to notice, you know, the flavors while they're eating it, but then also how they feel afterwards, inviting them to, you know, have about half of their plate filled with fruits and vegetables to be consistent with the myplate.gov guidelines or the Harvard plate guidelines. And so also we can find that we can often feel better after we're eating like really nourishing foods too. So we're heightening their awareness around that, but similarly around physical activity, around alcohol consumption, around how they respond to stress, along with inviting them to really set like action plans or goals or intentions of, you know, what they deeply want in their lives that also drives blood pressure, and to help them set goals for the week ahead to really act on those. And that was some of the work that actually is being done at the Rhode Island Department of Health too, like in the Wise Woman study, for example. And some of my work with the Department of Health actually inspired some of the work that we do in this program. It really helped make my research more practical. So I've been very grateful to that.
Were you surprised by the results of this study?
We hypothesized that the program would lower blood pressure, improve healthy diets, and one of the mechanisms would be improved self-awareness. And we pre-registered those primary outcomes like on clinicaltrials.gov, and so that we wouldn't do some kind of fishing expedition to just see whatever outcomes looked good and report on those. So those were our three primary outcomes, and we showed improvements in all three. So that's not always the case, but I, you know, was grateful to see that come through. I think the one surprising thing was like around the mechanisms. You know, we hypothesized that, you know, self-awareness was important, but also attention control and emotion regulation. And what participants were sharing with us is it wasn't like all three at the same time. What really came first often was the self-awareness, that they'd be like, yeah, you know, like when I'm on holiday and I'm not eating as well and maybe like drinking too much caffeine, it really affects how I am with my family members, that I can be more agitated. And so that self-awareness comes first. And then I can see like, yeah, I'm going to use, you know, my wisdom to actually shift my diet when I'm on holiday so that I have a better time with my family, for example. So often the self-awareness would come first, and then they would either use emotion regulation strategies or attention control, like attentional redeployment, to bring their mind into a healthier, happier place. So that was like one of the surprises that I didn't anticipate ahead of time. But once we saw the participants sharing that, particularly in qualitative interviews, that it made a lot of sense too. So we appreciated them sharing with us how they found the program operated.
Walk me through what happens. So if I were to come to you and say, Dr. Laux, I am interested in being more mindful. I'm, you know, my life is stressful. I'm a doctor. You know, things are crazy. I work for the Department of Health, COVID pandemic, blah, blah. I want to be more mindful. And I'm guessing that there's a lot of folks out there that probably have similar thoughts. How do I start to do this? Is this just taking a moment now for a minute or two? Is this something I need like an hour to do? How do you start to be more mindful?
Yeah. There's a lot of different approaches. And I find it's kind of like music, you know, like some people like jazz, some people like hip hop, some people like classic. There's no like right kind of music. It's just whatever works for you. And so like, say, you know, as a physician, maybe you'd appreciate like an evidence-based program. And so, you know, through Brown University at the School of Professional Studies, we offer evidence-based programs like mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, that are like 2.5 hour sessions, you know, once a week for 8 weeks. We also have briefer ones like Finding Peace in a Frantic World. That's like 1 hour sessions. That's sometimes easier to like fit into a busy schedule. So those are approaches that have all gone through multiple clinical trials. But then there's other approaches like Headspace or the app like Waking Up or Calm, where they can have like 1 minute, 3 minute mindfulness moments. Sometimes just a little bit frequently can add up to give us benefit. Those ones, you know, the apps aren't as rigorously evaluated through like clinical trials with long-term follow-up and independent investigators and stuff. But I think there's a lot of promise there. And then there's also just like communities, like say, you know, if you Google like the Rhode Island Community of Mindfulness, for example, have a number of different meditation groups that are like free to show up to. A number of them are online. Some of them, there's a number of online groups that are like really great with affinity groups too, like say BIPOC communities or LGBTQ plus communities, so that if we want to say meditate with groups that we have, you know, similarities with, especially online, there can be a lot of options there too. So sometimes I find it's just a matter of like trying out a few different delivery methods and then just see what resonates with you, depending on who you are and the time that you have and what your interests are.
Let me ask you this question. I have dabbled, and I mean very, very naively dabbled in a little bit of meditation. And I think to your point, one of the key concepts is focusing on the current moment and having awareness. And I find that when I do this, and other people have told me this, that about after 5 seconds, my attention starts to drift and I'm thinking about all the trillion things I have to do or this or that. And I, you know, even at my best moments, I'm going, you know, I'm lasting maybe a minute where I'm actually focusing on the present moment. Tell me, is this normal? And is that healthy? Is this the point of meditation and mindfulness to overcome these other distracting thoughts? How do you think about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A minute to be focused on one thing is impressive.
Well, maybe I was kind of overestimating there, to be honest, but, you know, at
especially
least
if that
seconds.
Thing's kind of boring, you know, like the breath, you know, so 5 seconds, you know, it's like that experience is very common. You know, I think the interesting thing is like, where did the mind go? You know, did it go to the future? Did it go to the past? Like, does it usually go to the future? Does it usually go to the past? Did it go to somewhere kind of like common territory, or did it go somewhere fresh and new? So like, there's a lot of learning and just where the mind goes. It tells us about who we are and how we are in that moment. Like where our mind went, no one else's went there. And so it helps us come to know ourselves. And once we know ourselves, it's kind of like a gardener who gets to know a garden really well and where to plant the plants, that we can just be who we are, but be able to create a life that best matches like what our nuances are. And when the mind wanders, let's bring it back to that object of meditation, like say the breath or whatever it is. And in time, we do get better at placing our mind where we choose to. And it doesn't necessarily matter if we're placing it on, say, the breath or whatever. What really matters is, you know, are we really there with like our families or with our work or with our patients or with, you know, the snowdrops that are coming up right now in the gardens, you know, like, so can we be there for our life? And so it's like that combo of, where does the mind wander? It's good information about ourselves. And can we bring it back? And there's whole research on the wandering mind. You know, there's really great creativity that comes from that. So we're not saying a wandering mind is bad. It's just having maybe a little more control over where we place our mind and allowing that wisdom to come through.
Let me ask you this. Did you have any official training in mindfulness? Is this just something that you stumbled onto during your research career? How does one become a mindfulness expert or experienced, at least? Probably just doing it, but is there a specific training that someone does to get into this field, curiously?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's lots of ways in. I think two of the main paths are through wisdom traditions that offer, you know, a lot of mindfulness or meditation training. And another path is through like certified evidence-based mindfulness programs that are more secular. And for me, I've done both. So I, you know, gravitated towards the mindfulness tradition, like a Zen tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh, who's like a Vietnamese Zen monk who's written over 100 books and offered it in a way that was like not trying to convert me to any particular religion, which I appreciated. But they trained me deeply, and I actually became ordained in that tradition. And I've gone through a lot of mentoring by senior teachers and, you know, studied it deeply, but practiced it deeply too. So I think my best training has come from that. And I've also gone through mindfulness-based stress reduction training and teacher training. So I'm a certified mindfulness-based stress reduction teacher. So got trained up at the University of Massachusetts, Worcester, originally. And then we actually now offer teacher training in mindfulness-based stress reduction at Brown University too. So really have been impressed with those teacher training programs. So that's how I got trained up in it. But other people, you know, they'll go to Burma for 2 years and like go hang out at some monasteries and do some hardcore meditation and really like serious training. And other people might find mindfulness training through other wisdom traditions. You know, it's really coming up, like say in Judaism or Christianity or Hinduism, for example, too. And, you know, it doesn't really matter necessarily where we get it from, as long as the training's really solid.
I am now putting Burma on my bucket list.
So, yeah, a lot of the like really senior original folks that brought mindfulness to the West were trained in Burma.
Cool.
India.
And Dr. Lux, let me ask you this. For the average person out there who maybe has never done mindfulness before, what's the best way to start? What are some resources? How do you even get started on this path? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit like I was sharing earlier, to like try out different pathways, you know. So, you know, if they want to check out the evidence-based mindfulness programs at Brown, just Google Brown Mindfulness and Professional Studies, and you'll come across our programs there. There's other groups that offer them too. You could check out, you know, different apps like Headspace. Insight Timer is free and has thousands of teachers on it. Waking Up is another one. And then just Google like mindfulness group or meditation group in your region, you know, and there's websites like iamhome.org or, you know, many others that you can get training in. There's also retreat centers like the Omega Institute, Kripalu, or two in the Northeast that are drivable from Rhode Island, for example. The Barry Center for Buddhist Studies and Insight Meditation Society are also well-respected. So those are some examples of places to start. But really the main thing is to try out different ones and see what best resonates with you.
We're here with Dr. Eric Laux, professor at Brown University, director of the Mindfulness Center. Thank you so much for joining us today. Our time is winding down. I feel like we've covered a lot today. I mean, I feel like I should almost ask you what the meaning of life is. But seriously, though, any final thoughts for our listeners? Anything that you've learned along your personal journey for mindfulness? Anything you want to impart the audience with?
I mean, I think we covered a lot. You know, just sending warm wishes to everyone who's listening, and sending gratitude to the Rhode Island Department of Health for all the work that they do to try to address social disparities in health, and the hard work they've been doing through the pandemic, and all the other community-driven work that I've really seen being led by the department too. So also really grateful to all the staff members at the Department of Health as well for the service that they provide to the state. There's a lot of heroes there that aren't always recognized. And when I was working there, it was really beautiful to see what's going on.
Well, thank you, Dr. Laux, for the kind words, and thank you for the work that you do. And thank you for joining us today. It's appreciated.
Yeah, my pleasure. Yeah. All right. Thanks.
If you'd like to learn more about the Mindfulness Center at Brown University and the work that they do, please do visit brown.edu/mindfulnesscenter, all one word. And if you'd like to learn a little bit more about following a heart-healthy diet in general, you can visit health.ri.gov/food/about/healthy-eating. In closing, I do want to thank Erica Collins, our executive producer, and Carol Stone, our technical director. I also, again, want to thank Dr. Eric Laux for sharing his expertise in mindfulness with us. Thank you again so much for joining us. And I'm Dr. Philip Chan, signing off on behalf of the Rhode Island Department of Health. Thank you all, and be well.